You're listening to the Body.com's podcast coverage of AIDS 2008, the 17th International AIDS Conference. The conference took place in Mexico City from August 3rd through August 8th, 2008.
Hi, this is Dr. David Hardy. I'm a director of infectious diseases from the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles and an associate professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, also in Los Angeles.
So what do you think were some of the highlights of the conference so far?
The biggest highlight for me, I think, here was something that we haven't seen for the past many conferences. Having been to all 17 of the International AIDS Conferences since I started in 1985, I can tell you this was a real eye-opener for me, not so much in the medications or their side effects, which has always been one of the biggest highlights, but in the socio-political realm. The fact that our own Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. has unfortunately been underestimating the number of new infections of HIV infection in U.S. citizens by 40% for the past 8 years at least is a great concern. And I think the fact that it's also highlighted that a risk group that has sort of started to become less and less important, meaning men who have sex with men and also men who have sex with men who are Black and Hispanic, and even worse, in my opinion, who are young, who are between the ages of 18 and 30, have been the fastest growing groups in this underestimation, really brings home the point that our epidemic is probably been much overlooked here at home. And that to me, you know, even beyond the fact that we are going to hear and have heard great information about new medications here at this conference, really points out to the fact that while we have bemoaned the fact that HIV is growing around the world, we've kind of lost sight of it. That's also been growing in our own backyard, and that's really unfortunate. I think this is an incredible socio-political point. The administration of our United States has overlooked this terribly over the past 8 years, and it's time to turn that around. I mean, I think the most important thing I came away from this conference was prevention, 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 and how we really need and have to start doing this in a much more specific way, or this AIDS epidemic is truly going to re-mushroom in our country.
So you've been to all these conferences, and you still have some hope that we can be successful in tackling prevention?
I think we certainly have seen that. You know, having been around in 1983 to 1987, right after the virus and the disease was discovered, men who have sex with men who were at risk did in fact change their behavior. And the new infection rate did plummet dramatically. So having seen that happen over 20 years ago now, I know that that can happen again. Unfortunately, the complacency and just the lack of information, the lack of knowledge, the lack of fear about what this virus can do to someone has, I think, been in large part responsible for why this disease is starting to reemerge very unfortunately, especially among young gay men and young gay men of color in the United States. And that's something that we really have to be aware of and start addressing. The other thing that's happening here, of course, is that is it not only blossoming in that risk group, but also individuals who are female, women, heterosexuals. I mean, it's not sparing anyone in this situation. And not to, I think, to scare people, but just to say, we can't ignore this. We can't ignore this any longer. We really need to go out and teach kids about sex. Tell them how to have safe sex from the very beginning. Not be afraid to discuss issues of life. And I think that's the important thing that I came away from this conference, is that prevention can work. We have seen it work before. So we really can't say communities of risk anymore. People who are going to have sex need to wake up and start talking about this and start realizing that this is a problem.
Not to get political, but do you think that in this election year, people should keep this in mind and that maybe with a new administration that would be more friendly to more progressive ideas about complete sex education, we could see this happen? Do you think it's dependent on that?
I think there needs to be a change of administration for lots of reasons, but this is one that really has brought it home for me. The message I would want to really take back to people in the United States, and especially those who vote, and I hope that's all of you out there, is that the health of our country is not good. We really need to take a look at that. And while we consider ourselves to be the greatest economic power in the world, our health care has, it's really substandard, subpar to what goes on around the world. And at this conference, what I realized was that what we bemoan as problems in healthcare and developing countries around the world and talk about how sad it is that they can't get access, they can't get medications, Our situation is different. We have access. We have medications. We don't go out and tell people about it or tell people how to get tested if they are, in fact, HIV positive and how to then access the medications that are very available in the United States. You know, I think our administration has been very, very lax in talking about issues of life, about sex, about drugs, about ways that people will be exposed to things all the time. The ABCs that were used in the past of abstinence, being faithful, condoms, are just not working.
And do you think one of the reasons they don't work is because they ignore the fact that gay marriage is not legal yet in America? And so how could gay people wait until marriage when they can't get married?
I think that's part of the piece of the pie. But I think even bigger than that is the fact that, you know, for some reasons, sex has become taboo in our country. And I think that's a real problem. Sex is a wonderful, beautiful thing and should be made a part of everyone's life. And not to tell children about what it is, young adults, but somehow expect them to not know about it and therefore be completely unprepared when it does happen. It's like sending someone out to war with no training, you know? It's crazy. It's crazy.
And no guns.
And no guns, right. And no guns. No condoms, in other words. But, you know, just to bring it back home for me, and being at this conference, it made me realize that over the past 10 months, in my relatively small practice of about 250 patients in Los Angeles, I have seen probably 12 young men between the ages of 21 and 29 become newly HIV positive. Half of them are men of color. And to me, that's something that is shocking. You know, I've not seen this sort of reemergence for years. And every single one of them have come in saying, I didn't know. I didn't think it could happen to me. And I've heard this so many times now. And just to see the statistics now really in a much broader sense here at this conference, to understand how we have not been able to determine who's becoming positive in an adequate manner, and therefore create prevention programs that really make a difference. Go out and tell the people at the bars, tell the people, straight bars, gay bars, wherever they're going to be, the concerts, the internet, where people communicate now, that this is a problem. This is a problem. People need to wake up and understand what's going on.
I heard an interesting term from a prevention activist who said it's the Hilda Spitzer syndrome. Because Hilda Spitzer is the wife of the governor of New York, and he was involved in a prostitution scandal. And it seems he didn't like to use condoms. And so Hilda Spitzer is, no one would have thought that she was at risk. And there are many women all across the country, and men, in similar situations. So do you think people are saying that risk groups, they're avoiding the fact that we're all at risk?
I think traditionally, you know, way, way back in the 80s, we used to talk about the four H's as a way people could identify if you were at risk: homosexual, heroin user, Haitian, or hemophiliac. You know, all that's been thrown out the window now. All that's been thrown out the window. No one can identify a risk group anymore. I mean, we all have risk groups because of the fact we have sex. Many of us have used drugs in the past or currently. All those things make a difference. And I think that's something that we need to stop thinking about risk groups and talking about life, how people are going to interact with other people in life. And Hilda Spitzer is a perfect example of that. You know, a well-to-do white woman who may, in fact, been exposed to HIV because of something her husband did. And, you know, who would ever think she was at risk? I think that is a perfect example of the fact that we can no longer pick and choose people who we think are at risk. We have to make this a very broad, universal sort of approach, and also of testing. You know, I think that's a thing that's also been overlooked by our CDC. The CDC makes these recommendations of what to do in terms of public health measures, but then doesn't have the power to go out or the money to go out and put them into action. That's the problem, is action.
Let's turn to treatment. If you were HIV infected recently, when would you start treatment?
My perspective on this has been changing quite a bit. You know, I think at this over the past over the past year, we've seen the guidelines change, which are usually one of the last places for that something to really happen in terms of changing the way that we manage HIV therapy. Starting medication has been recommended now to occur earlier in the space of HIV infection, meaning when CD4 cells are now below 350 as opposed to less than 200. That's an important advancement. Here at this conference, what I learned is that if we are ever going to have a chance of trying to eradicate this infection, we are going to need to start getting people on therapy much earlier, at least experimentally. Tony Fauci, one of our great leaders and researchers in this epidemic since the very beginning in the 1980s, had some very, very important comments about how with some of our new medications like the integrase inhibitors and the CCR5 cell viral entry blockers, that we may be able to have a real chance at trying to use these new medications in a way that may actually stop early infection and therefore prevent what allows the virus to create long-term latent or hidden infection for years, which has really been the stumbling block for why we can't cure HIV. So in my mind, if I became HIV positive and I knew it, I probably wouldn't wait. The safety of our medications now has improved dramatically. The ability for people to take the medications has improved dramatically. I think if I became positive now, and that's something I've considered many times in my own life, I would probably start treatment very soon.
Would you start during acute infection? Do you think that would help?
I think there's some rationale for doing that. The studies that have tried to look at that have not been overwhelmingly good in terms of showing long-term good results, but it may be because the medications we were using weren't the right ones. The new medications we have now, such as integrase inhibitors and, again, the CCR5 blocking medications that stop the virus from entering the cell to begin with, maybe the better medications to use very early on in therapy that can stop those early processes by which the virus gets into a cell and is able to stay there forever. What we call latent persistent infection, meaning the virus gets in, stays there, and is then hidden from our HIV treatment medications for a long period of time. And that's the stumbling block that we keep getting to in terms of eradicating HIV. So I think during treatment during acute infection probably does make some good sense.
Do you think we're any closer to finding out and learning about what causes metabolic side effects?
You know, the one thing I did hear that was interesting here was a way to try to see whether or not we could predict by looking at a person's genetic structure, looking at a person's genes or chromosomes, to see whether or not someone was predetermined, predestined to develop these problems. Certainly, one comment that many of my colleagues and I have made is that as we look around this conference, we see fewer and fewer people with signs of lipodystrophy. In years past, we've seen many AIDS activists, persons with HIV, with deeply sunken cheeks, protuberant abdomens. That has not completely disappeared, but certainly it's much, much less. And even though that's a very gross, you know, kind of overgeneralization of what's going on out there, we have learned in many ways to stop using the medications that we know were associated with that. The older protease inhibitors, D4T or Zaret, Stavudine, even AZT, are medications we no longer use anymore because they were associated with such bad side effects. I think we have learned from trial and error. This conference gave us a little more information about how we can perhaps pin down more on a genetic basis, looking at someone's genes, how we may be able to predict who's going to get it.
Don't you think that one of the reasons that you're seeing less facial wasting is because more people are using fillers in their cheeks?
I think it may be part of it. I think for the fortunate few who can afford it, that's very true. But the pricing of that, at least in the community I live and work in Los Angeles, is prohibitive for many people. And even with the faces being able to be reconstituted, so to speak, or rebuilt, you still have the wasting in the arms and legs, which is easier to hide, of course, but still evident for many people as well. So I think there really is a true decrease as to what was happening before, and probably one of the biggest differences has been the decreased use of the single drug Stavudine Zaret D4T that used to be a number one drug. It is now basically off the market in the United States.
Uh-huh. Can you talk a little bit about the Abacavir data that is being presented at the Late Breaker?
You know, I think what's happening with Abacavir is very, very interesting, and all of us need to sit up and take notice about what's going on here. Abacavir has been a medication that's been available in the United States for almost 10 years, since 1999, and it's been a very good and effective medication in many, many ways. It has, for example, been shown to decrease the chances of someone and even reverse the problems with lipodystrophy of the fat wasting in the face as well. There's some real advantages to it in that respect. It's available in a once-a-day pill teamed with another medication called 3TC and a drug called Epsicom. I've used the medication a lot in my patients. I like it. It's been very effective. The fact that we now have a blood test that can determine whether or not someone's going to have a reaction to it makes it even easier and more safe to use. At a conference earlier this year, and again at this conference, we heard information that could be potentially very concerning about its use, and that is the occurrence of heart attacks that may happen in persons who are starting to take it during the first 6 months of actually starting it or restarting it. How this happens, we don't know. Why it happens, we don't know. Is it real, or is it a statistical fluke of a large observational study? We don't know that either. We've heard conflicting information here from the company who makes the drug, who said that when they went back and looked at over 34,000 patients in all their studies with the drug, they did not pick up a signal that heart attacks were occurring more commonly with it. A second big 5,000-patient study called the SMART trial is presenting here at this conference the results of their study, in which they saw that there was not only increased number of heart attacks associated with the drug, but also increase in inflammatory markers, which we think may be associated with heart attacks as well, something that the cardiologists, the heart specialists, have told us from years past. Another study, on the other hand, has told us that there was not an increase in these inflammatory markers of abacavir from a clinical trial used with it most recently. So I'm in a bit of a quagmire here. I'm not ready to discard a drug that is effective. I think it's even more safe now in terms of its use. I want to see more information from it before I'm going to discard a medication that to date has been very important and very useful and very helpful and life-saving. If there is a continued signal that abacavir is associated with heart attacks, then we do need to look at that very carefully. But I'm not totally convinced yet.
Do you think it's mostly a risk in people who have already risk factors for heart disease or genetic histories?
My best guess of that would be to say yes, it would be. The fact that abacavir might be associated with more inflammation, meaning more of the white blood cells in our body running around, reacting to something, has been associated with heart attacks in general, not specifically HIV-positive people, but in people in general. That's why people take aspirin. One of the reasons is to try to calm that down before they get a heart attack or after they've had one already. If abacavir is clearly shown to somehow increase inflammation in the body somehow, then that might make a person who's already at risk because of high blood pressure, smoking, previous heart disease, family history of heart disease, diabetes as well, make them at more risk for heart attack as well. But that crucial link of does abacavir cause inflammation and therefore make a heart attack more likely has not been clearly proven yet.
If you were on Epsicum yourself and you had no risk factors for heart disease, would you change?
I think if Epsicum was working well for me, I had not had a reaction to it in the first 4 to 6 weeks, and I was on smooth sailing with it with a well-suppressed viral load, I would not change at this point.
What do you think are the most important unanswered questions in HIV?
I think the other important unanswered questions that I heard little bits and pieces about here as well was information about how the virus actually does its immune damage. We used to think many years ago it was a simple virus infects the cell, destroys the cells, blink, 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 and it's kind of one by one the T cells will be dropped off. We've known for years that's not really the whole story, and we've heard little bits of information here about how things like inflammation caused by the virus itself kills not only the cell that's infected, but other cells around it, as infected cells sends out inflammatory substances, things that used to be called evil humors back in the old days, that somehow cause other cells to die indirectly, cells that are not infected, but are affected by these inflammatory markers. You know, that might be part of what's going on. And I think we need to understand more about how our medications may actually decrease some of that inflammation, how some of them may actually increase some of the inflammation, and how we can better use our present medications and our newer medications, such as integrase inhibitors and CCR5 antagonist inhibitors, to better treat HIV infection based upon true understanding how the virus does its damage to the human body, not based upon what we have always kind of thought about before. I think the other new information we need to do is to really be open to how we can treat HIV infection better in the future. We have before us now a beautiful and a very promising armamentarium, a group of tools that we can create new and hopefully better treatments for HIV infection that work more specifically against the virus, that have fewer side effects, that are easy for people to take on a long-term basis, and that can really change the way that we view this epidemic in the future. But most importantly, and I want to underscore this yet again, Bonnie, is that we've got to get the prevention message out there. We've got to tell young people, especially in the United States, that HIV is still alive and well and ready to get them if they're not careful.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thanks for listening to thebody.com's podcast coverage of AIDS 2008. For much more coverage of this conference, including news, research, video, our photo journal, and, of course, more podcasts, visit us online at thebody.com/AIDS2008.